Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Alan Barless, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Combining high design and highest standards of sustainability, Alan Barless's vision has been central to the development of Barless Wedlick's industry-leading reputation. In 2018, Alan was elevated to the American Institute of Architects College of Fellows for his work and teaching in sustainable design. And over the last 20 years, Barless has built an award-winning full-service firm through a broad and distinguished body of work, including private residences, affordable housing, and sustainable commercial compounds. Alan, welcome to the show.
Terrific. Yeah, excited to talk.
Me too. I'm very excited about this conversation. I've been a big fan of your firm for a long time. We were talking a little bit before we started recording, back when I was up in New York. I used to follow what you guys were doing, and even back to the Cora days.
Yes, right?
you guys were part of the original founders of Cora.
And I thought I was going to surprise you with some of that history, but I guess you know it.
Well, I know it, but the listeners don't know it. So I want to hear the whole story. So
starting to become ancient history.
Let's jump into that conversation. I want to hear your origin story. So go back beyond Cora. I want to go back to where you discovered architecture. Who inspired you to become an architect? What inspired you to become an architect? And share that story to where we are now.
Sure. Well, you know, let me lie down on the couch here for a minute.
I've been accused of that in the past. So.
Right. No, I. That's great to take time to think about. And you know, a few times you get a chance in life to really think back to where it came from, as opposed to just kind of relying on that wellspring of passion that we have in this field. My family's from New England. I was born in Boston. And when I was young, my dad was in the Army. We moved around a lot, and I moved, ended up at a pretty young age down in Florida. And I always ascribed that change, that radical early life change, from really being a part of, like, you know, walks with my mom looking at bricks. I mean, I guess I did. I don't quite remember. But, you know, she we've been back, and she showed me where we used to go for walks, and just that kind of attachment to a real urban setting, a real sense of place, a real kind of, you know, a notion of history and the way humans live in the world that Boston is just, you know, does such a great job of, you know, the outskirts and the inner city and the places in between. And we would go back every, you know, a few times every year. So I had a connection to that type of world, but I was growing up in what at the time was kind of swampy, nothing, you know, farmland starting to turn into suburbia. pre-suburban Florida and watched all that happen and just was, you know, kind of completely, you know, taken over by what was happening to that environment, how that environment was being, you know, completely overrun with, you know, kind of what really, some, you know, sometimes feels like wanton destruction of you know, highways and malls and such, and just the contrast between what I really associated with place and how we had to carve that out and find ways to understand that in the suburban context. And somewhere along the line, I the next thing that comes to mind is that I went to my local library in my tiny town and somehow stumbled upon the one shelf that was labeled architecture. And I really don't know what got me there. Maybe it was liking art and other things, but, and in my small town, if I remember correctly, there were three books. and one was about Frank Lloyd Wright, and you know, that's kind of all you need. And one was Our House to Bauhaus, which I probably didn't read yet, but later did. And another one was a compilation of, you know, the Four Masters with Mies, and you know, so it was just, you know, there was just I couldn't believe what I was learning about, and that this was a whole place you can spend time thinking and theorizing and understanding why the world looks like it does. And so I was completely hooked, you know, through the next years. I went to a high school that actually had a it had some of us doing AP classes and some people doing shop, and there was actually an architecture program that was part of the vocational part of the school. And I did a 2-year class with a architect teacher, and learned how to draft, and actually, you know, that was supposed to let us go out in the world and become architects. It was really kind of that way of thinking about just like, you know, shop and engineering, and you know, we were learning a skill, and you know, just knew that that was something that I couldn't shake. I didn't really know. I had to kind of go around and find architects to find out what the hell that meant to be an architect, and interview them, and just I was pretty aggressive about getting to know what that world was like, and then kind of directed myself to a graduate program eventually, and that's where when I was at MIT in the 90s, my best friend was the first employee of Dennis Wedlick, who had become my partner, and he was working every summer with Dennis, and Dennis at the time was still wrapping up his time at Philip Johnson's office, and you know, Paul was just enjoying himself so much, and so when we graduated, I moved to New York and moved in with my brother temporarily, thinking I actually had a stint with city planning in New York and in Europe, actually, before I went back to grad school. And I thought I was going to go be a part of some big firm that did, you know, kind of urban scale, you know, work. I had a degree in sociology and urban studies, and that was the kind of place I thought I was heading, and just parked myself at Dennis's office for what I thought was a short time so I could steal the color copier and work on my portfolio. That was it. Nothing much has changed since then. That's the last move I made. Dennis and I hit it off. You know, we had a fateful crash, thanks to FedEx, of a model that I had stayed up working on during that brief time. And I was the one who knew how to put it together. We were presenting to Gerald Hines down in Houston, and it just was like, oh, I wasn't really doing anything. I'll get on a plane and go down and fix it for a couple nights and meet Gerald Hines. And on the plane on the way back, Dennis and I were like, well, let's do something here. And so we kind of charted a course toward a partnership. And we partnered in about 2005. And the firm has pretty much stayed steady. since then. And getting back to the Cora thing, it's like as we, you know, kind of moved, evolved and grew, not so much in size, but just the kind of work we were doing, you know, I was learning and running projects and eventually running all of the studio of the projects, and Dennis was having more time for what he now is completely doing, which is, you know, community organizing and you know, kind of higher level thinking. He's now evolved Chrysalis style into someone who is able to you know, really work on the part of our firm that has always been careful to think about not only community and the architecture community, but also the rural community where we work, and doing a lot of work with our multifamily affordable housing and that end of what we do. So we were facilitating that trajectory where he would be able to do that kind of career 2.0. And along the way, you know, the story where he was one of the founding members of CORA, the Congress of Residential Architects, which is really the founding body that turned into Custom Residential Architecture Network, you know, kind of getting AIA to actually recognize and create chapters. And so we have a role in the work that we are still doing. While we don't have conferences, we still have great sessions. There's actually one tonight at the New York Cran Apple, we call it, New York chapter, which is very active, and Dennis has been very active in helping get that moving along.
So you were founding members of CORA, correct?
Mm-hmm.
What inspired CORA to happen?
That is, you know, really just feeling like there's a lot of very interesting things that happen at the residential scale. We do, I think it's maybe like 60-40 or something like that, residential work, but we run ourselves like a residential firm. We relate to more individuals, even if it is a corporation or an institutional body, we're interacting with them as if it was a family. And we want to understand their wishes, and we want to think about a place that they're making forever, and we want to make it feel like a home for them. And so whether it's an institutional project or a commercial project or a residential project, we work all the same way. And that kind of practice is special, and tended, especially it felt back then, to not really be getting the kind of support that it could have from, be it conferences or, you know, rules that the AIA was setting, charging us dues for, and you know, giving us support about. There's just a myriad of things that we felt were missing. And so, you know, we really just created it. Jeremiah Eck and Duo Dickinson and Dennis and a lot of help from, you know, Hanley Wood and Claire Conroy, you know, just creating a community where we really looked forward to getting together and talking about how complicated it is to run a firm and you know, think about the type of work we do and the volatility of the type of work we do. And gosh, I mean, you know, there was a conference called Reinvention for maybe about 10 years
that we used
to look forward to. And I think a lot of our best thinking, we would take all of our associates every year and have our own kind of offsite sessions at that conference, and then talk with other people like us. A lot of our same friends in our network today are, we made it those in that realm, and just really dependent on each other to think things through and learn from each other and share stories with each other. It's really been foundational for us. And at those conferences is where we, you know, kind of were able to step back from moments like the, you know, Great Recession, and say, what the hell are we going to do? And what was everyone else saying? And, you know, where were some of the alternative paths people were taking them? And what can we learn from people who did that same thing back in previous recessions? And that was really the birth of such a pivotal moment for our firm in 2007, 2008, where we, you know, kind of doubled down on our stance on sustainable architecture and said, let's focus on keeping our firm alive through the recession and do a passive house that we were just learning what it was and how that could crystallize so much of what we were doing in our firm. Those kinds of ideas came out of that community.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I want to talk about. I want to talk about your doubling down on sustainability and passive house and how that's affected your firm, both business-wise and the architecture that you do. I do remember that movement when Cora happened. It was very exciting as a young architect, sort of experiencing that out there and seeing that response and the conference. And I'd like, you know, I didn't realize it until you and I are talking right here, but it had a major impact on me and has absolutely influenced what I've done with Entree Architect.
Oh, that great. I'm certain that makes total sense.
Yeah, definitely an influence.
It makes sense that you're kind of carrying this on in a way.
Very much so, yeah.
You'd be doing the Cora podcast, basically.
Yeah, very, very much so. And because it was very inspiring, very needed, right? The residential community was essentially, I mean, you're not going to say it, but I'll say it, AIA was ignoring us. And that was a big piece of what Cora was about. I mean, that there was a manifesto and this is what we stand for and why we've organized. And it was very exciting. And today with CRAN, it's really evolved into CRAN and has sort of come back to the AIA. And CRAN is an excellent organization as well. They really do great work nationally. And as you said, locally, there are chapters for CRAN. And yeah. So for custom residential architects. And so I just wanted to mention that it certainly has had an impact and an influence on the community that we have here at Entree Architect.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
I want to get into sustainable architecture and how it has affected and influenced the work at Barlas Wedlick. So you had just mentioned that it was. Was it specifically a response to the recession that we're going to focus on this specific type of architecture? What was the inspiration for sort of specializing in it?
I think it's really more the space that was created. I mentioned I had a stint in city planning, and it was back when there was. A recession in the early 90s and you know, graduated into a recession and been through a couple of these and there is, it's always such a wonderful moment where, you know, up until that point in New York, it was the developers saying, we're going to do this, and New York City tapping them on the shoulder and saying, well, do you mind if you also put in a little park next to that while you're busy doing whatever you want to do on the city, you know, and then the recessions happen, and that's when all these amazing people who have all these amazing thoughts of how the world could be actually have time to say, well, why don't we do it this way? You know, there's not as much activity going on. There's not the drumbeat of make the dollar, serve the next thing, keep going. You know, you get a chance to breathe and you know, maybe that's this fortunate thing of they come around every 7 years and we get a chance to reevaluate.
There's a cycle for a reason.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we just like coming off of what we're doing right now with this pandemic. This
very
really,
much so.
I mean, as we're starting to come out of it, I'm really, you know, I'm trying to say it positively, but I'm kind of anxious that we might lose some of these wonderful lessons that we've been able to get out of this kind of thinking, rethinking, reexamining, unearthing of things that we took for granted and we didn't understand, and we didn't understand the impact of, and we didn't understand the involvement of all kinds of parties and supply chains and all these things that we really need to understand, that it's just so clarifying, these moments. And so, and we have to just really know how to not just get right back into business as usual, but learn these lessons. So we knew that, and having been a firm that's been around, you know, this long, we'd been through them before and we knew how to survive. You know, our office was around the corner from, you know, downtown New York in 9/11. Like we've had to deal with various ups and downs, and we always find that it helps us grow into something better. And so I think we kind of felt prepared, although it was a really devastating time.
Yeah.
That you know, work just dropped to almost nothing for everybody, and we had an amazing group. We still have an amazing group. We always have, you know, been proud of having a great pretty, you know, tight and small, but great group of people who are really dedicated, who all believe in the tenets of what you talk about in your podcast, the idea that we are, you know, bringing about great architecture, but we also have to think of this as a business. We have to be smart about how it works. We have to understand everybody, no matter how junior you are in our office, you have an understanding of, you know, the project management and the billing and the client relationships and all of these things, because, you know, that's what makes architecture great, is if you can work with all of those parameters and towards success. And so we had a great group of people, and we were not about to let them go. And you know, we were on a roll. I mean, the work we've been doing had always been informed by a desire to bring the best quality services and products and design to our clients, and in that needs to be a sustainable, efficient, energy efficient, and generally smart way of building. And but we really I think the early 2000s, late 90s was it'd be interesting to write that book of how confusing it was to think about sustainable architecture successfully back then, pre-LEED, and then even with LEED, especially for residential architects, LEED for homes. We all got LEED accredited, but it wasn't the answer, because right. It didn't really make sense for most residential clients to pay for the paperwork and all of that. And it was really a collection, a checklist, and not quite as successfully answering any one or few things that a client could really find benefit from. So we spent years being frustrated, hiring consultants, and being lucky that we had great clients that were attracted to the fact that we cared about the environments and we wanted to try to do, and we were kind of working in the vein of passive solar and reuse, reduce, reuse, recycle, anything that we had been taught in school, Dennis and I, that we thought we could make sense of. We were, I'd say struggling with finding that we had something that made sense that could be, how do we do it again? How do we make it better? How do we, it was like starting over every time, and every client was different, and we did the best we could. We were very proud of the work, but this break gave us a chance to say what's working, how do we make these things work, how do we really get to the bottom of what success can look like, and maybe most importantly, how do we get this to be something that not only are our clients excited about, but that we can be advocates for, so that the market can get excited, because we want to not only just get lucky that we have some clients that call us and say, as they still do sometimes, oh, I'm sure you'll sprinkle around that green stuff and maybe geothermal or a green roof or a wind power, and that's great. You start wherever you start, and we'll talk about what's appropriate for your project. And maybe we will have a green roof, and maybe we will have solar power. But, there's a lot of things that when you're open to it, clients want to learn about and care about and rely on us to be the guardians of what is great practices, which includes not making them compromise for what they want, on budget or on, scope of the work or their wish list. We really, that's our job to get them great, energy efficient, sustainable work that shouldn't cost them more and shouldn't deter from their desires. And that's a wonderful challenge, and it's totally fun. So we wanted to figure out, how to get better at that. And we had the time, because we didn't really, we went down to a trickle of clients. And luckily, one of our clients was Frank Siami, who does some development work. He's a contractor extraordinaire in New York City, and mostly known for institutional buildings of the highest quality, but also passionate about construction in general, and passionate about thinking about residential, the question of, the famous $100,000 house question, why aren't we better at serving the residential community from a construction point of view. And we had been working with him on a number of projects, and one of them was one we were still working on when we went to that reinvention conference in, maybe it was 2008 in Austin, I think. Austin was a great place to be doing that kind of thinking. And we, you know, everything, I remember being on the phone, stepping out of the conference and being on the phone, you know, with their office, and we were paused on the project that we were doing, which was the perfect project. You know, how do you do an efficient, in today's construction standards, how much prefab, how much on-site, you know, what's the best way to bring the best product to the most people? And that was just, you know, an ideal assignment. And it paused, and we said, well, this shouldn't pause. This is the question that we need to ask now. And at the time, we had just found out about passive, and we had always been doing, we kind of were learning, you know, how do we do this? Dennis took, I think, the very second course that Passive House Institute US offered, and I might have taken the sixth or something. You know, our whole office was taking the courses, and we were understanding the principles of Passive House, and we evaluated the design that we had done for that project and realized that a lot of the basic tenets that we were following about efficiency of material and efficiency of space and solar orientation and, you know, concentrating on the production of the materials and the efficiency of the materials in the envelope, all of those things happened to be the same things that Passive House was organizing for us and had, you know, codified in Germany in 1990. After really being born, I think, you know, there's debate about that and interesting stories about that, but really, you know, born in many places, but really, you know, most of the roots that we understand were here in New England in the time that, you know, certainly maybe not us, but our teachers were going to school in, you know, the 60s and 70s, and we're still around teaching us. You know, all of these amazing ideas, often at a residential scale, what is the best way to build? And all of those principles were kind of, you know, in formation through the 70s and 80s. And then it all vanished with the, you know, Reagan-Thatcher era and the removal of the solar panels off of the White House, all that story. So we, you know, it found its way to being, you know, kind of systematized in Germany, thankfully, in a way that really could be, you know, depended upon and taught and shared and exported, and then, you know, kind of brought here in the early 2000s by Katrine Klingenberg and it with Passive House Institute US, and so we got involved after we had heard about that in I think it was around 2006, it might have been in the New York Times, and so we were starting to kind of understand it, but we used that project to really become a test case and a learning lab for us to then say, well, what if this house had to meet the Passive House standard? And we were glad to know that most of what we were doing was in the right track, and that's been, you know, the clarification of everything we've ever been working on, and ever since, everything we do is able to kind of follow a set of, it's not, you know, rules, it's that we have, it's not prescriptive, but it's performance based, that we are able to understand how to make our buildings better in a way that also results in better air quality, better, you know, resilience of materials, you know, everything that we had been hoping that we could kind of put in one effort is really also guided by what we do with Passive.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. Now, you've probably heard of Zaha Hadid Architects. They're one of the world's best known firms. And when it comes to innovation, they're big fans of pushing boundaries. The team at ZHA has started using Twin Motion, a simple real-time ArcViz tool that lets you instantly visualize ideas and clearly communicate them to stakeholders. ZHA designer Marco Marchetta says that the benefits of using TwinMotion for the designers are the simplicity of the interface, the playfulness with which you can articulate your scenes, and not having to worry about all the technical aspects that real time usually brings, like light maps and PBR workflows or other technical details. Marco also loved Twinmotion Cloud, which lets any member of the team access the project from their web browsers without a single download or installation. The project manager can access the model, review it, and immediately give you feedback anytime from anywhere, says Marco. To download a free trial today, visit our exclusive URL, twinmotion.link/entrearchitect. That's twinmotion.link/entrearchitect to try Twinmotion for free. BIM can be important for your next project, but it's not the only thing you need for your next project. That's why it's important that 95% of manufacturers who offer free BIM files on RCAT also offer another type of data or information that your project may need. That means 95% of the products with BIM also have CAD files, are in a specification, in a patented spec wizard, or may have product information to help you make the right selection. So stop going to a site with just BIM and go to RCAT.com to get everything you need for your next project for free and without registering. No cost, no credit card, no email. It's free. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com. When building a business you're passionate about, it's easy to feel like there aren't enough hours in the day. And if you're doing all the invoicing and accounting on your own, you're probably spending time on work you don't love. FreshBooks is built for business owners like us. It's the all-in-one accounting software that saves entrepreneurs and freelancers up to 11 hours a week. That's 11 hours that you could spend nailing a client pitch, designing your next project, or building your business as an architect. From preparing, sending, and following up on invoices, to tracking and managing expenses, to processing online payments, FreshBooks automates and simplifies all the tough and annoying parts of running your own business. So try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. Go to entrearchitect.com/freshbooks and enter entrearchitect in the How Did You Hear About Us section and get more time back to build the business you love. That's entrearchitect.com/freshbooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. Passive House has given you sort of the codification of the sustainability that you've been working on all these years. And so it's helped you internally, for sure. It's helped you sort of confirm of what you've been doing has been on the right track. It gives you sort of a structure on which to design future work. How much has Passive House helped you from a business point of view, from the external, from the marketing of your firm and how you communicate what you do to your clients?
That's a great question. Like I said, it was a formative moment for the way we think and work, but it also was a formative moment in the way that the outside world could understand what we were doing. And it's a little bit purposefully blurry between what we were doing for the Passive House, well, for, you know, architecture in general and for the Passive House community and the Passive House movement, you know, this idea that there is a way of thinking about building that we want people to know about. So there was from the beginning a lot of intention on what this could mean for everyone's practice, but also for our own. And I think what really, you know, the biggest thing that happened was because we had been doing we've always had our practice has always been a wide range from affordable housing we're doing with Habitat for Humanity to gargantuan projects with huge budgets and everywhere in between, and a lot of mostly in between, we had the ability and the fortune of the fact that that project that we did during the Great Recession was really not, client-driven. It was the sky's the limit to what can we try to do with this. People were getting together. The builder, Bill Stratton, contributed. Siami contributed. We contributed. Lots of people wanted to come in, and you know, nobody was really doing anything. So lots of people wanted to. Vendors wanted to contribute. So we were able to, between that and our in-house interiors and the work that we usually do, we wanted to bring it all to bear. So we also, in addition to, making it a great performing house, made it a great looking house, and made, it was this kind of small prototype, but it really, should be ready for its close up and to get, photographed and seen by the world, and, the same, wonderful photography that Peter Aaron was doing for us for our, big portfolios, he, was doing for this house. And it just really looked great, which is an important part of, yeah, of getting a message out. And people in the community and Katrine have said as well, it was a way of kind of having an icon that caught people's attention because, and this is what we talk about this all through my class at City College is, what is it about, what are the fundamentals of architecture and how do we reckon with the fact that, there still is a very image driven culture of consuming architecture. And yet there's a greater sensibility, especially among students, of responsibility and actual, real effectiveness and productivity and sustainability and all these things that don't necessarily photograph as well. And how do we, what do we do with that as designers? How do we take that as a design problem and solve it? And I think that project, which actually is almost looks kind of like an A-frame house, the way often, kind of symbolizes to me like a fulcrum point on a seesaw. It was like, that was a moment where things still for us pivot on that iconic house that really spread around the world. We still get calls from people. We actually helped a client build a version of that house in England and Norway. There's different, there's people around the world who've latched onto that house partly because of its powerful imagery. And I think what it did for our firm and a way to kind of get attention for the kind of work we were doing, that was a big part. It had a lot to do with what we, how we could be seen. And also to your question, really helped us kind of solidify a way of talking about what we do, and just, say that we, care about this. That's a little bit more complicated because it's not everybody needs to meet the passive house standard. So, it's in the rules that it says it has to be, it has to be optimizable. It has to make sense from a budget point of view or from, and so some projects might not make sense completely but that doesn't mean you can't use the principles and you can't be aiming for that level of that standard, but that it is part of what we care about, how we think about what good architecture is. And it still remains in service to this bigger point of we want to bring our clients, the best work. So that being able to give that message more clearly to clients has been a huge benefit as well.
Yeah. You talk about that project as a turning point in your firm, sort of externally, people recognizing you now for that type of work. Your current projects that come to you, how much, because you're very well known for well-designed homes, right? That's a big piece of your brand. The clients that come to you today, how much of when they're coming to you, how much are they coming to you for the design, and how much are they coming to you for the ability to be able to integrate that sustainability into that design? Or is you're just doing it, or is the sustainability just built into everything that you're doing and people are coming to you because the design is there and they get the sustainability as a bonus?
I'm happy to say it's hard to answer that.
it was hard to ask it.
Well, but I get what you're saying, and I think I'm glad that it's unclear, and every call, every client, every project is different. But I can say high level, that it's something that sometimes you think one thing and it turns out to be another. I'm really happy, to know. And I sometimes never know whether it was that they understood. There are people that call us,
right,
and we'd even know what Passive House is, which is increasingly happening, which is great. Or at least, I just got a wish list from a new client the other day, and it was like the first line was, a super airtight envelope with, good insulation. And,
yeah,
and
so check.
That you saw that was something that we do. So you are showing me that that's on your mind, but they didn't even know that that was something that we did. And I'm just thrilled that it's hard to know whether they're getting it from, the fact that there's more information out there in the world, and or that it's just something that people are more aware of and expecting, or whether they learned about it after they found out about us, or some mix. And a lot of times they don't even know. It's, oh, I heard about it, or did I hear [S2] Right. [S1] About it after I met you, or did I hear about it before I met you? The important thing is that it's happening. And so, yes, we are thinking about, we can't think about building any other way. And a lot of the clients and builders and anybody who's kind of done this kind of work, just it becomes part of what they do. It's really about craft, and it's about building. And so, anybody who cares about that and once you start thinking, oh, well, that makes sense, we can achieve that level of energy efficiency and just by kind of thinking some of these things through. And it's still fundamentally, so we built that house in 2010, and we spent the next 5 years kind of, as I say, kind of green eggs and ham. Like, it can look like this, it can look like that, it can be for this budget, it can be for that budget, it can be done on any site and any orientation and any size and so we really needed, and we were thrilled when we got, and maybe it was like 2015 or 16 or something, we got on the cover of Dwell for a house that was recognized for its interiors. Oh, and it happens to be a passive house. Like, was a huge success of advocacy is working. And now it's not only about that. It has to be that, oh, and it happens to be a passive house is where we want it to be. I'm concerned, and my students remind me, almost every year there's someone at some point who says, are we going to get where we need to go at the rate we're going? Like, how many have you done? And, we have to believe that, that we're pushing, and there's some great, thank God there's tireless and creative people in the community who are thinking about all kinds of wonderful ways to get the word out there and to bring this to more projects and to bring this to more jurisdictions. So it becomes ideally more integrated into regulation or at least incentive. There's just so many avenues for growth that are starting to happen. You can see that every year in the Passive House community conferences. And thank God for all the people who are pushing on all those fronts. And we're doing, the best we can, but yes, it's great that the word does get out there, and that we do get people who either find us because of that or find us and then are happy to have that as part of what they do. And then, like I said before, it has to be appropriate. And so it's not always reaching that standard, but it's always part of the thinking.
Yeah. How much do you think the focus on design and the focus on your business being a successful business has given you the freedom to explore sustainability and do the things that you really feel is the right thing to do as an architect?
Let me say that one more time.
Well, your success, financial success, your business success,
oh, okay.
Right? The focus of making sure that your business is financially sustainable, mm-hmm. how does that give you the freedom to sort of do what you want, right? To find the clients that are willing to do what you want, but also to just, this is the way we design it, take it or leave it, right? And not everybody has that flexibility because no, not everybody.
Let me correct that. We don't either. we are the only thing that we're starting to mature into is being able to say that we want to work with people who are nice.
But what gives you the freedom to be able to do that?
That right there, we do. We have earned that, but that's like the first thing that we would grab on a list of you know, it's still a tough world, and yeah. it's still there are some clients who are actually concerned that you know they want to make sure that you are not trying to serve, you know, to your question, like they would. And I believe this is important regardless. I mean, even if we did have the kind of ability to, you know, kind of pick and choose clients or pick and choose projects or influence where projects were going to go, first of all, we don't believe that that's what architecture should be. It's got to be a collaboration with a client for a client. It's got to make sense for that client, for that site. It's that, and we love that challenge of making great architecture for those clients and for those sites. It's not about our own vision, which you can tell from our work is pretty varied. It's helping, you know, find the right beautiful timeless thing that makes sense in that place and time. But we have some people who say, you know, that, you know, they wouldn't want to think that we might be serving a different master and saying, well, you know, this has to become passive. And in fact, maybe I've started to get some more of those calls recently where someone's like, okay, well, you know, are you interested if this house is not yeah. going to fit those performances? And so, you know, we want to work with people who want to work with us. And we love that challenge of finding the right answer for that project. And we want to make sure that they understand that what we will end up doing with them on the spectrum of you know, energy efficiency or general sustainable measures is something that they buy into and it makes sense for them. So, you know, I don't think we would, you know, I don't think we're even aiming for being able to, you know, kind of decide what we are working on. We're lucky that we get, you know, great people who are calling us, who found us, who are open to talking about what is best for them. And maybe there's something going on. We've always been suspicious that there's something going on, you know, out there in that world before people make the call to you, where they're censoring themselves, where they're, you know, deciding not to call us because maybe they suspect that we might be right. trying to be green or something like that. But we still work on just a wide range of projects that you know, it might not come up much at all. And you know, that's in service to giving the best products to those clients. That's it's not that we'll still work on it, and we'll still make those houses, you know, do much better than code, at least, you know, but also we do want that. We do believe in that for the future of the planet, and luckily enough clients wouldn't reject that notion. And I guess maybe they censor themselves before they call us if they would reject that notion.
Alan, we're talking to thousands of small firm architects, many of them running their own small businesses. What would you say is the one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
I think that the bigger level lesson that we could take away from what we've done that's been successful is really, you know, focusing on your passion and focusing on what is, you know, authentic for you, what you care about, what you really want to be able to bring to your clients, what you enjoy doing. The more you stick to that, the more you, you know, get what feels like lucky that people will call you to do that kind of work. And then you do more of that work, and then you do more of that work. And everybody's got different interests. You know, everybody's got some angle, even within the sustainable design world, there's different angles of what people care about. And if you really, take time to understand what makes you excited and what really drives you to you know, get up and these days sit on Zoom all day and get through and just feel, you know, just challenged and excited and curious about what you're doing and what could be next and what other things there are and really go through. I mean, it's a wonderful privilege, but I think it's a lot of what a lot of people get into architecture for. You can't not do it. You know, if you're in love with it, you can't not do this. You know, I was supposed to be a doctor and I signed up for the MCAS, but I just didn't, I couldn't not do this. You know, so if there's something about this that you care about, and you stick to it and you want to focus on it, you know, that's going to lay it all out for you. That's going to lay out what you do with your firm and the people you hire and the people you work with and the consultants and the relationships you have. And it just, you know, you find other people, you know, that are like-minded, and it's your community. I don't know if that's a too general.
No, that's very good advice. I mean, especially seeing that in the very beginning of our conversation, you were talking about how at that moment you doubled down on your passion for sustainability, that this is what we're going to be known for. And that's what has brought you to where you are today. And so I think that's very good advice, that if there is something that interests you and that you are passionate about it, consider double downing on it. And double downing, is that the right word? Doubling down on it and making it what you do, right? Because not only will it, you'll feed your passion, it will allow you to create a practice built around it, but it will also differentiate you and it will help you from a business point of view. And so that's excellent advice. His name is Alan Barless. Barless Wedlich is the firm, and it's barlesswedlich.com is the website. We'll have that link on the show notes. Also, check out their Instagram at barlesswedlich. We'll also have links to CRAN and all the other things we talked about on the show notes. Alan, thank you very much for coming on Entree Architect podcast today and sharing your story, sharing your knowledge. It's an inspiration. I appreciate you and everything you guys are doing over there.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Links to all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode, found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. And thank you to RCAT, FreshBooks, and Twinmotion for their support of this podcast. Entree Architect is proud to be a partner with the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. We're curating thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership, ready to edit business resources, live monthly training for architects, business training that is, a supportive architect community, yep, it's there, and Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. It's in there for you at Entree Architect Academy. It's waiting for you right there at the membership. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends. Visit entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, happy, safe, and secure. Thank you for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.